And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, on the web at KUCI.org, and on iTunes at College Radio. And today is Wednesday, April 4th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Dennis Palumbo. He's a writer and licensed psychotherapist in private practice, specializing in creative issues. He's the author of Writing from the Inside Out, published by John Wiley, as well as a collection of mystery short stories, From Crime to Crime. He's formerly a Hollywood screenwriter, and his credits include the film My Favorite Year, for which he was nominated for a Writers Guild of America Award for Best Screenplay. He was also a staff writer for the ABC TV series Welcome Back, Cotter, and has written numerous series and episodes and pilots. His first novel, City Wars, published by Bantam, is currently in development as a feature film. And his short fiction has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and elsewhere. He provides articles and reviews for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Lancet. His column, The Writer's Life, appeared monthly for 6 years and written by the magazine of the Writers Guild of America. He's done commentary for NPR's All Things Considered, and he writes a regular column for Psychology Today. His new crime novel is Fever Dream, and Mirror Image came out just before, maybe a year ago, and he's here for the entire hour with us. I'm very happy about that. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Barbara, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, I also wanted to say that for those of our listeners out there who want to hook into things you're doing, like the Psychology Today column, to go to your website, DennisPalumbo.com, and they can subscribe from there or find links to it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
They can also learn information about my new series of crime thrillers featuring a psychologist in Pittsburgh named Daniel Rinaldi. The first one, as you said, is called Mirror Image, and the second is Fever Dream. They're both from Poison Pen Press, and I'm currently at work on the third one.
Well, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that and talking about all sorts of things this hour, but, you know, I wanted to just say before we begin that for those listeners who may be new to the show and new to you, I just wanted to say that we've spoken a few times on the show. You've been on panels. You've been at the salon. So to you, some of my questions may seem repetitive, but to our listeners, they may be brand new. So don't think I've forgotten what we already talked about. I just want to fill in everybody.
That's okay. With my aging brain self, I'm lucky I remember what happened yesterday.
Well, let's begin by talking about Fever Dream and about Dr. Daniel Rinaldi, who is, like you said, is a therapist, and he lost his wife to a murder. A stray bullet lodged in his brain for a time, which makes him immediately sympathetic as a main character. But talk about how the book came about, how Rinaldi came about, and then why you gave him this tragedy.
Well, it's interesting. I've always liked mysteries and thrillers, and in fact, over my long writing career, the very first thing I had published was a short story in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine way back in 1978, which certainly dates me. But anyway, it was the same year I started on Welcome Back, Cotter. But I'd always wanted to write mysteries, and it always had been a dream of mine to create a series character. I'm an enormous fan of writers like Michael Connelly and Dennis Lehane, and so I knew I wanted to write a series character. And the two things that interested me the most was my field of psychology. I've been a licensed therapist for over 25 years. And the fact that I grew up in Pittsburgh and went to Pitt, and that the city of Pittsburgh itself is such a changing place. I mean, it's literally the old city of Pittsburgh is being built upon by this new gentrified city. And I thought, wow, that'd be a great place to set a crime series. You know, as my editor at Poison Pen says, yeah, Daniel walks down the mean streets of Pittsburgh. But anyway, the point is, since I'm a therapist, I thought, why not make Daniel Rinaldi a therapist? But I'd also have spent the last 5 or 6 years in supervision with one of the country's leading trauma experts, Dr. Robert Stollero. And so I thought, well, what would be interesting for a therapist is if he was a trauma expert, if he was his specialty was treating the victims of violent crime. Therefore, there'd be a reasonable connection, even though he's in private practice, with the Pittsburgh police. They would refer people to him, crime victims who had been traumatized by being kidnapped or being held hostage in a bank or being raped or being the victim of a domestic dispute or something. And, of course, being who he is, he gets involved in helping to solve the crime. And I thought, my experience is, only the wounded physician can heal, as Jung said. And so I really felt that for Daniel to really have legitimacy as someone treating trauma victims, he needed to survive a trauma himself. And so that's why I had him, have his wife murdered in a mugging. And moreover, because I made Daniel a former amateur boxer, he feels he should have been able to protect his wife, and he was not able to. She was killed, and he was put into a coma for a while because of this bullet in his head. And he had years of therapy to deal with his survivor guilt and his own PTSD symptoms, post-traumatic stress symptoms. So I thought this made him a sympathetic and very relatable hero, and we would understand his sense of mission when it came to helping his patients. So that's how the series started.
Now, as you said, Rinaldi is close to you in certain ways. He's in Pittsburgh. You're from Pittsburgh. He's a therapist. You're a therapist, although his specialty is different. Are you ever concerned, or have you been concerned with the division between fact and fiction in terms of the book is not autobiographical fiction yet? You have brought certain true aspects into it. And do you ever worry about, readers wondering who you are in relation to him, or just any sort of confusion between you, the author, and Rinaldi, the character?
Well, I think because the things that we share in terms of our autobiographies are so generalized, that we, both grew up in Pittsburgh, we both went to Pitt, we both worked in the produce yards when we were in high school. But my father's a grocer and my mother is a homemaker, and they're both Italian. In Daniel Rinaldi's case, his father was an alcoholic Italian cop, and his mother died when he was 3, and she was Irish. So our personal biographies are very, very different. And moreover, Daniel, was a street kid and an amateur boxer, and much braver and more resourceful than me, So he's sort of an idealized version, I think, in that regard, because I was kind of a nerdy, straight-A, good boy student, and Daniel is stubborn, snarky, sarcastic. But he and I do share the opinions expressed in the book about the mental health field right now. So one of the things that's real fun, that's real pleasure for me, in writing the book, is that Daniel and I share the same slightly maverick view toward clinicians and the mental health field and how diagnoses are misused or overused. So he's a wonderful vehicle for me to talk about the state of mental health in America.
And it sounds like you're also, from what I know about you, you're more relaxed in terms of, let readers think what they want. You're going to write the book you want.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, I'm, at that stage in my life where, I write what I want, and it's sort of like the thing Melvin Peebles Sr. said about his films. He said, I make films the way I cook dinner. I hope everyone likes what I cook, but if they don't, I'm perfectly prepared to eat it myself. And that's the way I feel about my writing. I try to write really interesting, relatable books with a lot of twists and turns and a lot of suspense. But I'm mostly interested in character. And, one of the things that I think is unique about this series is that my hero's best friend is a paranoid schizophrenic. And that relationship is one of the things my readers seem to just love.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, about side characters and how important they are to the main character and to the story?
Oh, I think the side characters are hugely important because, for one thing, they help create a verisimilitude in the world of your character. I mean, my hero has, you know, an ex-lover who's now a friend, Nancy Menders. She's in the series, and we see her grow and change. And his best friend, as I mentioned, Noah Fry, is a paranoid schizophrenic that he met at a clinic years and years ago. And he gets to, you know, the funny thing about Noah is, you know, he sort of, as he says, he stays just this side of crazy by use of medication, and the fact that, in a funny way, like a lot of the patients I met at the psychiatric hospital where I was an intern, outside of the hallucinations and delusions, they often saw people and the truth of things with great clarity. And so that's how Noah functions for me. He's sort of like the crazy wise figure in Native American culture, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he's just a fun character to write. I mean, I could write Noah and Daniel arguing about music or politics, you know, till the cows come home. It's one of the real interesting things about writing a thriller is because so many of the characters I find so rich and fun to write, there's a real temptation to just write them talking to each other for page after page, but you want to keep the book moving. But the thing that's most, I think, valuable about these side characters, and there's ancillary characters as well, is there's the policeman that he deals with. There's two police detectives, one male and one female, with whom Daniel has an ongoing and sometimes bumpy relationship. But what they do is the reader gets to see these people grow and change, you know, get divorced, struggle with substance abuse, get promoted, get demoted. The things that happen to all of us in real life happen through the course of the book. So you really feel like you're on a journey. And while, you know, you don't have to have read Mirror Image to read Fever Dream, everything does unfold in a kind of long-term way in terms of what's happening to the characters.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, and I'm here for the entire hour with Dennis Palumbo, and his most recent book is called Fever Dream, published by Poison Pen Press, and it's a Daniel Rinaldi mystery. So along the lines of plot isn't as important as character, how do you then construct a story that keeps a reader's interest beyond character, you know? I mean, that keeps the suspense going, that keeps the reader turning the page.
Well, you know, Henry James said plot is character under stress.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key. I mean, in both Mirror Image and Fever Dream, there's the sense of a ticking clock. There's a lot of suspense. There's the potential of danger all the time, and there's a lot of red herrings. But mostly, I think what keeps—I mean, both books have been called page turners, you know, by you know, Kirkus and Publishers Weekly, and I've been very gratified by the reviews. My favorite one from Kirkus calling Daniel Rinaldi Jack Reacher with a psychology degree. But the thing is I like books that really move along. And the way to do that is to make the stakes very high, life and death stakes, and to keep events happening. That as long as you keep surprising the reader, keep pulling them through, wanting to know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm. Talk about red herrings and how you come up with them. I mean, is it something that unfolds when sort of a tangent unfolds that maybe misleads the reader and characters lead you into those red herrings, or how do you come up with those?
Well, that's actually kind of the way I do it. I mean, some writers outline their books very carefully and know every chapter and what's going to happen. And I tend not to work that way. I work very spontaneously. E.L. Doctorow said that, you know, for him, writing is like driving home on a mountain road at night. The headlights only show you 10 feet ahead, but sooner or later you get home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I do. Like, when I was writing Mirror Image, I was halfway through the book before I knew who the killer was. and then I just go back and seed in all the clues. I prefer my characters to surprise me. In Fever Dream, something happened in the middle of the book that I had no idea was going to happen and turned out to be the most exciting thing about it, I thought, and is the source for readers of their greatest surprise. And it surprised me, too. And it was literally, you know, literally seeing a character do something, and I go, oh, my God, why is he or she doing that? And I went, oh, my God. And that, so they the characters have, if you're doing it right, in my opinion, they have a life of their own. And they begin telling you who they are. And if you're open to surprise and willing to rewrite, see, the other thing is I don't mind going down a wrong tangent for 10 pages. Until something kind of hits me, and I go, oh, well, this is, I don't think I like this. But I'll find a line of dialogue or a character description that I'll use or save. But I don't mind going down the wrong path. I mean, the book I'm writing now, Night Terrors, I wrote the first chapter about six times until I finally understood what it was about. And then once I understood what it was about, I knew how to end it on the hook that would move the book forward.
Interesting. Okay. This would be a great time to have you read from the book. Could you read maybe the first page or two?
Okay, how about this? I just pulled a section out just because I thought it'd be fun. I've been reading the first page so many times I practically memorized it. But this is just two pages from the book just to give you an idea of what's happened is there's a woman named Treva Williams who was the only hostage released from a murderous bank robbery attempt. And Daniel Rinaldi was called in by the Pittsburgh police to help deal with her because she was so traumatized from her experience that while they're on scene and the bank is it's a robbery in progress, the police are trying to get information about who's in the bank, do they have guns, and she's so traumatized she can't talk. So Daniel treated her. Later in the book, she's in the ICU at a hospital, and he's promised he's going to come and visit her. And so this, and because of her ordeal and because the bank robber got away, they've put a detective in front of her room at ICU to watch her.
Okay.
And this is what happens.
Excellent.
Finally, night, crowding out the last faint rays of a stubborn summer sun, though a stale heat still lingered, fringed the air, made the darkness heavy, oppressive. I pulled into the parking lot at Pittsburgh Memorial under the glowing UPMC sign. Only a few cars dotted the line of spaces, the roofs shining like new coins off the glare of the parking lot posts. I went into the hospital through a side entrance, bypassing the main reception area, and took the elevator up to the ICU, where, to my surprise, the doors opened onto a deserted corridor. Silent, empty. I paused a moment, then stepped out of the elevator, heard the doors close with a whispered rumble behind me. The corridor wasn't just deserted. It was dark. Long shadows painted the dull walls, making gray the familiar hospital white. I looked up, saw that the overhead fluorescents were out, tubes of flat black that ran the length of the high ceiling, disappearing at the end of the hall. I took another step, and glanced toward the nurse's station. It was empty. The wheeled chair behind the semicircular desk was pushed back against the corner, as though shoved there, as though somebody had bolted out of it in a hurry. I swallowed, felt my heart revving up in my chest. Something was definitely wrong. Steeling myself, I started down the corridor toward the last room, Treva's room. The first two rooms I passed were empty, silent, unlike earlier today. No sounds of machinery pumping, no beeps, blinking lights, pneumatic wheezes, and no patients. Again, unlike earlier today. I remembered that there'd been one in each of these rooms. Now the rooms were dim as caves, lit only by a rising moon's faint glow through the window slats. The beds were stripped, sheets gone. I'd been around ICUs enough to know what that meant, or what it usually meant. The patients had died. But where was the night nurse? More importantly, where was Treva's guard, Detective Robertson? That thought made me swivel where I stood, nerves wound tight, vibrating, fight or flight. Nothing, and no one. Then I looked again toward the end of the long, shadowed corridor, saw for the first time a soft, pale light that bloomed faintly up ahead, coming from the last room, somehow more ominous for being the sole illumination in the darkness of the silent ICU. I squinted in concentration as I drew closer to that light emanating from Treva's room, gripped by a sudden, visceral sense of foreboding, of dread. The light grew brighter, a few feet more, and something caught my foot. Big, heavy, soft, I stumbled, clawing the air, righting myself at last by grabbing the door frame at the threshold to the room. I peered down into darkness. A body lay on the floor at my feet, a large-bellied man, jacket thrown open. I got to my haunches, made out his features in the light from Treva's room. It was Detective Robertson.
Thank you so much. That was Dennis Palumbo reading from Fever Dream, published by Poison Pen Press. Talk about the idea of a series that, well, two-part, actually. There's two parts to the question. One is why you wanted to write a series. I mean, in terms of, you know, I'm sure before you came into this, you know enough about marketing to know that readers love series, and maybe, you know, how much of that was a part of it. But the other thing is how to write a series where each book is also a standalone, so that someone would not have to start with Mirror Image, with your first mystery, that they could start with Fever Dream and then, you know what, I want to read the first one.
Well, that's actually the funny that you should say that. That's the publisher's belief. Most of the really well-known mystery authors, it takes four or five books in their series for them to become a known name. You know, someone reads book number four or five at the airport and likes it and says, I'm going to go and go find the first four. And so most of the time, publishers like series because they build an audience as they go along. For the writer, I think the value of a series is to create an alternate world that you can use as a way to explore your own ideas about things. I mean, I really respect writers who write standalone thrillers, but if you are lucky enough to create a protagonist that people like and can use this as a sort of mouthpiece, the value of a series is you have this alternate world in which you can explore, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, Mirror Image primarily explores the mental health field. Fever Dream primarily explores politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the Attorney General of Pittsburgh is running for governor, and that is a backdrop to the whole story of Fever Dream. And I get to write, you know, a friend of mine is a very high up political operative in the Democratic Party, so, you know, I just got a bunch of interesting things from him. And, you know, so I think then, and, you know, and the Night Terrors is about Daniels being brought in to treat a retired FBI profiler who, after 20 years, you know, living inside the heads of serial killers, is having night terrors.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to talk about what it must be like to do that work. So each book gives me an opportunity to explore something different. And in fact, because of I was a screenwriter for so many years, and because Pittsburgh has become the second Los Angeles in terms of shooting movies. They've just shot The Dark Knight Rises there, and they're shooting Tom Cruise's next movie there. My fourth book is going to be about a Hollywood film crew that comes to Pittsburgh to shoot a movie, and that the star is wigging out, and Daniel's called in to help her. So I get in each of my books to use a different kind of context and then have my familiar character take us there. It's sort of like the TV show Columbo's. I love that show, and one of the things I loved is that Columbo's character was our entree into the world of the murderer, whether he was a classical composer or a Hollywood studio executive or a police commissioner or whatever. And if you think about each episode, it wasn't just about catching the bad guy. It was Columbo, like Candide, being brought into a world and learning about how this weird world worked. You know what I mean?
And yeah, I do.
That is one of the real values of a series. I mean, my friends who write series, authors I've read that I admire, when they talk about series characters, they all say the same thing. You know, the risk is you get a little tired of the character, but the benefit is if you allow the character to grow and change over the course of 8 or 10 books, you can explore various aspects of your actual world using this character as your eyes and ears.
That's fascinating. I love that. Okay, we're going to take a very quick break and be right back with Dennis Palumbo. So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Writers on Writing
every Wednesday morning
at 9 a.m.
with Miss Barbara
and Miss Murray.
Did we say it was Wednesday?
Wednesday!
At 9?
Wednesday!
In the morning?
Wednesday!
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, on the web at KUCI.org, and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been here with Dennis Palumbo, whose most recent book is Fever Dream by Poison Pen Press. I wanted to just sort of continue what we were just talking about, and you had mentioned Pittsburgh, placing this mystery series in Pittsburgh, and I was thinking about authors I know who create fictional places based on a certain city, or so that it's not really like Susan Strait has Rio Seco, which is Riverside, but not really Riverside.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Well, it's like Ross McDonald put his Lou Archer novels in Santa Teresa, which was Santa Barbara.
Yeah, and I think Sue Grafton does that maybe too with a city up there, not Santa Barbara, but another one. And can you talk about that and why you chose to use an actual city, apart from the fact that you're from there and know it, but why an actual city as opposed to a fictional city?
Well, for me, it the value was, well, there's two. To be honest with you, part of it was nostalgia. I just liked imagining myself back in some of those places and then, you know, remembering them and writing about them. And even though the book takes place today, you know, in contemporary Pittsburgh, which is very different from the old Pittsburgh, Daniel remembers the old Pittsburgh, and so he gets to have a foot in both worlds. But I think for me, I just like a real city because it adds verisimilitude. And you know, I'm sure a lot of authors say, well, you know, if I use a fictional city, I can create all sorts of corruption. I can talk about the police force. I can, you know, make the mayor a pedophile or whatever I want to do. But the reality is, even when you use a real city, you can do that. I mean, you know, the district attorney of Pittsburgh right now is not named Leland Sinclair, you know, but he is in my books. But I think the value, I'm sure, for people is who use a fictional city is they feel a lot more freedom to you know, make the roads go where they want them to go or have a situation happen that they want. But I've never felt restricted in that way. I really haven't.
Do you have to worry about any sort of libel or if you, you know, say you do create a, you do base your book in a city and the mayor is corrupt, even though the mayor may have a different name than the real mayor. Do you have to worry about that?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. It doesn't seem to be an issue that I've ever really heard about because you say the name of the character and the character is not the same person. I also think it's wise to go to a certain level and stop. I mean, I'll talk about the district attorney of Pittsburgh and I also talk about the mayor, but he's never described or even called by name. I'll just say the mayor, you know, because that level, you know, I'm not interested quite in that level. But yeah, I don't think there's any problem. I think if you started talking in a libelous fashion, see, remember too, libel is very difficult now that you have to prove malicious intent. And there's also artistic freedom. I mean, if a character in you know, a Daniel Inaldi novel wants to talk about some, I don't know, let's say skepticism about Rick Santorum, who's a former Pennsylvania senator. That's not libelous. You know, that's an opinion. I think if he said, you know, Rick Santorum, you know, secretly was embezzling money from his bank or something, then I think you start moving into malicious intent and you have a problem.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, and certainly it's probably nothing you should worry about when you're in the creation stage.
No, not at all. That's why God invented lawyers. You know, because, you know, every book, you know, they do vet it, you know, and
yes.
And like when Poison Pen Press, they were very upset in my editor was upset in when I was writing Mirror Image when she read the manuscript and saw that there was a statute of limitations on child abuse. And she went, "Is this true?" And I said, "Yeah, it is." And so where I'm concerned always is that I have the legal and clinical material just right.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very meticulous about that. So if I have, you know, Daniel wearing a wire, which he does in one situation, in Pennsylvania, no evidence gathered in a taped conversation where both parties don't know they're taped is admissible in court. So you need to know that.
Okay. You know, a few questions came in for you, and I think some of our listeners know that you wrote Writing from the Inside Out and love your advice on the art and craft of writing. And so one question came in that said, it would be interesting to hear a psychologist explain why he or why a writer chooses to write in a certain genre.
That's a fascinating question. I'm not going to give what I would consider the definitive answer because I don't know it.
Right.
But I can give you my opinion. I think, in my case, I've always liked solving puzzles. And whether it's the puzzle of a person's life and the narrative of their life, or just a crossword puzzle, I like the satisfaction of putting clues or ideas together and arriving at a conclusion. And so I think that's one of the reasons I like crime stories. I think the other reason I like them, and I think, you know, I talk about this. I did a column 2 weeks ago for Psychology Today called Taking the Mystery Out of Writing Mysteries. And what it talked about, and I think this is important, is for many writers, it's the vicarious pleasure that a crime story gives you in writing. Because, you know, I think everybody has operatic passions, You know, you vehemently hate your brother-in-law. You vehemently love your next-door neighbor, but you can't because she's married, whatever. In crime fiction, you get to do that stuff. You get to run your brother-in-law over with a car. You know what I mean? And so the outsized passions that we all have and suppress in our daily life because we're social beings and because of the social contract, in mysteries and thrillers, people get to do them. And so the reader gets the vicarious pleasure, as they do in watching soap operas, of seeing these sort of outsized passions acted out. And then, at the end of the mystery, most of the time, when the culprit is caught, you then see the social order restored. And I think for both writers and for readers, there's something very compelling about that.
Mm-hmm. What about, though, say, noir, which is a crime form where things go from bad to worse, and they don't necessarily get better, and there isn't necessarily a victor at the end, that
I
darkness
know, and it's
wins out.
One of my favorite types.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love James N. Cain, and I love Chandler, and very much like Jim Thompson and Cornell Woolrich, you know, the really dark noir writers I really love. And what I think is so appealing for both the writer and the reader is these are explorations of the darker passions in humans. And to be honest with you, the gut level conviction on most people's part that things go from bad to worse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, most of the time, things at best end in a kind of raggedy, ambiguous fashion. And the thing that noir fiction does and noir film does is it acknowledges the shades of gray in human behavior, that nobody's all good or all bad, and that usually straying from the social compact gets you messed up. It just really messes you up. You know, they're in a funny way, they seem so extreme and weird, but they're also sort of fundamentally conservative, because people who commit crimes, you know, do adultery, murder their spouses they don't love and stuff, come to a horrible end. And so they're almost morality tales with the thrill of sex and violence added in.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, another question is, can you ask Dennis about the fear of success? I have no problem with failure, rejection, etc., but success, now that stops me in my tracks. What the heck is that about? What recommendations does he have to keep moving forward instead of self-sabotaging one's efforts?
Well, I bump into this sometimes in my practice. It's not a question you can answer in a kind of general way. I would have to know something about this person, primarily their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have patients for whom, for example, the idea of succeeding at a level higher than their older brothers is unacceptable. Or that if they outshine their parent, they feel shame. There's a number of female artists in my practice for whom the idea of becoming very successful is so contrary to the family mythology about the role of a woman or the role of a girl that they really struggle with this all the time. And so most of the time, this is a huge generalization, most of the time, fear of success is the idea that you're moving out of where you consider your appropriate role in the family,
mm-hmm.
or in society.
Hmm.
It's sort of like, who am I to think of myself as successful? And usually you're helped along by this by a parent who essentially says, who do you think you are?
Mm-hmm.
You're having ideas above your station. You know, and some of it's even cultural. You know, when I was a kid, I worked in my dad's Italian food store, and anytime some, you know, one of the neighborhood kids got into, like, Harvard or something, everyone would all stand around, oh, hell, I knew him back on Larmer Avenue. He's not so special. You know, there's this weird thing that culturally there's even, you know, some fears that success will move you out of the familial context, and you will betray or leave the family unit. I mean, one of my patients who's a very successful film writer, his father told him when he began breaking in, he said, all you want to do is get famous and leave your family behind.
Hmm.
And he's haunted by that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's caused him an enormous amount of problems.
Hmm.
So while I don't know who your listener is, who and what his or her story is, mm-hmm. I would suggest that he or she investigate some of the dynamics of the messages they were given when they were young about what success would mean.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. You know, it's really interesting. I love that. And speaking of screenplays, what is the biggest creative challenge or common mistake that screenwriters face or make?
Wow. Screenwriters make so many mistakes. And I know because I've made them all when I was a screenwriter. I think the number one thing particularly new screenwriters make is, first of all, they have to understand that screenplays are about structure, that movies are almost fascistically devoted to the first, second, and third act structure. And unfortunately, every movie producer and studio executive has read all the books about writing screenplays. So they very much expect to see the hero show up on page 3 and the first inciting incident on page 10 and the first act break on page 33. It's become a sort of lockstep about that. But the real mistake I think screenwriters make is not understanding that they cannot make the script bulletproof, that it is a work in progress, that even if somebody ostensibly likes your spec script or likes your screenplay and wants to buy it, that's step one. Once a director comes aboard, once a studio becomes involved, once an actor is attached, everything in the script is up for grabs. Everything can be rewritten and changed. I have a screenplay patient right now who's written a beautiful screenplay about some Christian Africans and their escape from intense child slavery. And the first thing that the heavyweight director who was brought on and loved the script, the first thing the director said was, do they have to be Christian and does it have to happen in Africa?
Uh-huh.
So screenwriters are often stunned and appalled to learn that once people like what they do, it leaves their hands.
Mm-hmm.
They, unlike playwrights and novelists, they do not retain copyright on their screenplays. And they are considered by most people just the scaffolding upon which you build a movie.
Mm.
And so it really is hard for screenwriters because they do not control what happens to their scripts.
Right. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Dennis Palumbo. His most recent book is Fever Dream, published by Poison Pen Press, and he's also author of Writing from the Inside Out, published by John Wiley. So understanding that screenplays and novels are different forms, and if a writer is skilled at both, as a novelist and as a screenwriter, what's better to do? Is it better, like, if you do want and hope that a movie would be made for your book and you're writing, you know, a story that seems to have potential, would it be better to write the book and hope it's optioned as a galley or as a book, or write the screenplay?
Well, people have done both. I don't know what's better. I actually think it's not usually a good idea to write in one medium hoping it will be translated to another.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, for me, I wanted to write these as novels. I mean, there's some interest in the Daniel Rinaldi character as a TV series, and that would be great if that happens because I think that would sell more books. But I just see him as a character in a novel. And I think to write something authentically, you have to ask yourself, how do you see it?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean,
right.
If you see it as a film, if you're going to create Avatar, that's a film. If you're going to write Presumed Innocent, that's a book.
Mm-hmm.
And Avatar would be a bad book, and Presumed Innocent was a bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great novel.
Right.
So I think rather than say, I'm writing this novel in hopes it will be optioned, that feels to me having too much of an eye on the marketplace. And so then the authentic core of what you're writing, I don't think gets expressed.
Yeah, so even if you appreciate and like both forms, whatever the idea is, you really have to find sort of the context.
Yeah. I mean, since My Favorite Year took place against the background of a live television broadcast, of course it should be on film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't even imagine it as a book, whereas with rare exceptions, I like mysteries and thrillers that are novels. because the characterization is deepened and the author can bring you into a whole different world in a very particular way, and the author's voice really matters. I mean, when you read Chandler, for example, or Patricia Highsmith, their voices, their authorial voices, are as important, and in fact, I think the primary pleasure of reading those books, more than, you know, this year's plot or that year's plot. You know, I don't really care what Chandler's investigating. I just want to be in his head. You know, I want to be in Philip Marlowe's head. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, the voice. I mean, so often that's what captures us.
That's right. And in screenwriting, with rare exceptions, it's very hard to have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it a little, but it's very tough. Whereas in prose, I mean, one of the things I love about writing prose is Daniel Renault, you know, they're told in the first person, and there's a particular voice that I like.
Yes. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. What about crossing over into a new genre or leaving behind a creative area that you are, you know, enmeshed in? I mean, you have done this. You have moved from, you know, screenwriting and writing for TV to writing a nonfiction book on writing to writing mysteries. It seems like there's always the fear of, will it work out or not? And yet, you know, you have to then balance that against the desire of how much you want to do something.
Yeah, I think that there's always some risk, but I also think that nothing's ever wasted. I mean, when I was a TV and film writer, I primarily wrote comedy, and people are often surprised that I'm writing these mystery thrillers, but there's lots of humor in them, and particularly in the dialogue. So I feel like, you know, the experiences I had writing for, you know, at comedies helps keep my characters rounded, and they can talk to, you know, to each other. You know, as one of my readers said, you know, I love all the snappy one-liners. Well, you know, I spent my 20s and 30s writing snappy one-liners. and the other thing is as a film and TV writer, you learn to get to the point quickly. And I think that really helps for a prose writer so that the writing isn't flabby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really you have clarity, you have conflict, and you have a kind of, you know, Thomas Perry, a writer I admired, said something really nice. He said that I wrote a combination of well-rounded characters and propulsive action. And the propulsive action came from my screenplay days,
mm-hmm.
because in sitcoms, you know, it's just three jokes a page. Set them up, boom, set them up, boom. But the characters came from the fact that I live inside people's heads 8 hours a day as a therapist. And I love the freedom that prose gives you to really explore those characters.
Yeah, interesting. We have just a couple of minutes left. You know, I noticed something I wanted to ask you about, and that is that in terms of fears and writers of crime fiction, whether it be mysteries, you know, horror, whatever, that basic genre, I did an event with Dean Koontz the other night and learned that he won't fly. He's afraid of flying now. And Ray Bradbury wouldn't fly. There's a few writers of that genre that will not get on a plane. And so I'm starting to wonder, do writers of you know, crime fiction have more fears than writers in other genres?
Boy, that's an interesting question.
I mean, do writers of crime fiction imagine the worst possible thing?
I think it depends. I mean, look at Michael Connelly. He worked on the crime desk at the L.A. Times for years. So his view of the human condition is somewhat skewed, and so that would lead him to write the Harry Bosch novels. I think in my case, you know, I hear about people's fears and anxieties all day long, and I think, you know, as a therapist and as a, you know, thinking person, I believe most people walk around in a state of barely suppressed existential dread. And so the idea that someone's going to break into your house, or that a terrorist is going to blow up your plane, or that somebody's going to freak out and unfortunately start shooting up a school, which is happening with greater and greater regularity, there's the sense that the world is not only uncertain and arbitrary, but it is dangerous, and held together by a thread. And I think that at their deepest core, that's what people feel, because that's what children feel. You know, the psychologist Alice Miller said, our childhood is the air we breathe. And I think whether you write horror or fantasy or science fiction or crime thrillers, all genres are really, you know, living daydreams. You know, they're that the fantasy realm of our imagination where having to pay taxes and do our jobs and, you know, suck up to our boss and stuff is the adult persona we walk around with all day. But underneath that, we're all scared to death. And I think crime writers, horror writers, whatever, cue into that in a very particular way.
Hmm. Interesting. It's been great. This hour has flown by.
Thank you so much for, you know, if your reader or listeners are interested, I'm going to actually be speaking next week at the Orange County Sisters in Crime. You know, it's in Irvine.
Okay, on Sunday?
Yeah, it's on Sunday.
A week from Sunday?
Yeah, a week from Sunday at the Irvine Ranch Water District.
Yeah, so, out on Sand Canyon.
Yeah.
And there's info about that on your website, I'm going to assume. Okay,
yep.
DennisPalumbo.com. Excellent. Thank you so much for
Barbara,
taking the time.
I always love coming on your show.
Well, thank you. That was Dennis Palumbo, and I always love having him here. I think he's just fascinating and one of the best guests ever. So get him on as much as we can. We're at the end of our time. I'm going to leave you now, and I think Marie will be here next week. So next Saturday, a week from this Saturday, is Literary Orange here at UCI. Excuse me, I'll be moderating a panel on memoir. So hopefully you will show up. And more about events coming up are on my website, penonfire.com. My book is Pen on Fire. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'll see you next time.